Oh, we're on. You see, the problem is you get Nadine Garner in the studio and you just want to talk Bob Dylan, you want to have a little gossip. Nadine Garner, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm so thrilled to be
here. Yeah, it's fantastic. Now, I need to know, when did it all begin with you and Bob Dylan?
Well, I used to sit in the back seat of my dad's Charger. Actually, it was a little later than the Charger. My dad was a Bob Dylan fan.
Really?
He's no longer a Bob Dylan fan. He's moved away from Bob. But I used to sit there going, turn it off, he can't sing, as an eight-year-old in the back of the car. And then as I matured, I kept running into Bob Dylan fans from the time I was, you know, like 13, 14. My friend Ben Mendelsohn was a Bob Dylan fan. And then my other very close friend, Chris Langman, who I worked with on the Henderson Kids, was a Bob Dylan fan. And it kept being reaffirmed back to me. And so I just kept delving in. And I've dropped in and out in my life. But then again, in my late 30s, I think I went, nah, where is Bob when you need him?
Yeah.
And went back to the great man.
What would Bob say? You know, some people say, well, what would Keith Richards say? You and I perhaps say, well, how would Bob look at this particular situation? And you saw him recently.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous.
Yeah, it was fantastic seeing him at Margaret Court Arena. I got a bit obsessed with his wig. I don't know about you, Brian, but when you are in love with someone, and I'd have to say I am in love with Bob Dylan as an entity, as a performer, as a poet. Probably not as a person. I don't reckon he'd be that much chop as a guy to kind of hang out with.
Look, I met him. Part of me thinks don't drop this story in, but I will. In 1986, he was touring Australia and a dear friend of mine worked for a television program and they were sending someone out to interview Bob and she rang me and she said, I'm worried. This guy doesn't know enough. Take him out for lunch. Top him up with your Bob Dylan knowledge, send him off, and so the interview won't be a complete disaster. The guy was amazed at the depth of my sort of enthusiasm, and he said, look, I'm going to need someone to carry my bags.
That was a euphemism, right?
So we went to the Rockman Hotel, and I positioned myself between Bob and the door.
Don't.
So he would have to walk past. And as he did, I thrust out my hand. Look, it wasn't a fabulous handshake, I'll be honest with you.
Was it a little bit limp?
A little limp.
Yes.
A little fish-like. But I said, thanks, Bob. And he said, yeah. Which,
that's all you want.
Was enough.
Exactly.
What is it about him? We will move on to
I'm very
career.
Happy to never move on. look, for me, I think he's the greatest living poet we have. I feel a little like I'm living in the time of the greatest poet on earth, I suppose. And I realise that for a lot of people that is just a scandalous thing to say. But, you know, we've had Shakespeare. And if you lived in his time, maybe you felt that way too. Maybe you looked at those texts and went, we're living in the same time as this guy. That's incredible. Or maybe they didn't know that.
I wonder if they did.
But I feel like you and I know we're living in the time of a Shakespeare and that in 400 years' time, people will look back and go, check this stuff out.
Yes.
It's deep. It's amazing. And I love the fact that he's immortal and he talks about loss and love and longing and all the trials and tribulations of being a human being, but then he can be profound and he can transcend what it is to be human at the same time. And he's alluded to that in that he has said, oh, look, it comes through me, not from me kind of thing. So,
and he can be playful and witty. There's a new podcast I've discovered called Pod Dylan.
Yep.
And essentially it's a Bob Dylan nut, a bobhead.
Yes.
Who takes one Bob Dylan song and spends 30 or 40 or 50 minutes discussing that song with another bobhead. And the first one I listened to was Highlands from the Time Out of Mind. And it's a 13-minute song and it goes from being a sort of dissertation on aging and the futility of living. And then it moves into this fabulous little scene in a coffee shop in Boston and the waitress is trying to sell him eggs and then they don't have any eggs and she's trying to get him to sketch her. And it's funny. It's hilarious.
Well, he is hilarious. That's the other thing. He has a very, very unique brand of humour.
Yes.
That a lot of people don't see. It doesn't land with them, but it lands with me. I think he's incredibly funny.
Well, I'm delighted. We do. Miff has a little segment, an occasional segment called Words That Rocked Your World, and we'll come back to it because we got the whole half hour with you.
I love it.
But you have chosen a Bob Dylan song. Now, the new show, Mr. Black.
Yes.
With Stephen Curry.
The beautiful, incredibly talented and funny, speaking of funny, Stephen Curry. How beautiful is he on screen?
From that opening moment when he decides to partially destroy
that young suitor.
Lad's car. Give us the synopsis. Essentially,
it's a young couple who have moved in together. They're going to get married. They're planning their future. The father of the daughter, who's got a terrible illness, a degenerative bone disease, has decided to move into said household and try and split up the couple because the boy's just not good enough for his daughter. So, you know, there's some fabulous kind of Grecian themes there about...
Yes.
And Stephen was too young for the part. He'd probably like to tell you that himself. But they had to sort of age him up a little bit so that he looked old enough. And he's just this sort of, you know... recalcitrant, nasty piece of work that really wants no one to have any happiness because he has none. So he's very misanthropic. And so all the humour comes out of that kind of misanthropic nature of his.
And he's stern and he's frightening. And I can tell you, as a young man who went out with a couple of gals who had fathers who were rather tough... It resonated for you. It's very confronting when you're wooing this young girl and her dad just can't bear you and puts you through a couple of tests.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the sandhills behind Marimbula, but I won't go there. Now, your character, you, of course, play Stephen Curry's ex.
Yes.
And there's a marvellous... vitality, there's a sparkle. And in fact, it reminded me of a quote that I read about you. Often I get cast as the psychopath or the villain. Now, you're not a psychopath, but you're a little naughty.
Well, look, she spent a lot of her life trying to make that marriage work. She stuck around in that marriage to raise their daughter. He was a bit of a pig of a guy, you know. He probably stopped seeing her and loving her properly in the true sense of the word many years ago, but she stuck by him. And, you know, when we meet her in this show, she has left and her wings have spread and she's found a new life and a new lease on life and a new boyfriend and a new wardrobe. And she's living on the Gold Coast and she's just kind of in her sweet spot as a woman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, her villainy comes from her own joy, which is what really sets him off. So the more she is happy with her life, the more he wants her back. And there's the rub. And there's the fantastic frisson that Stephen and I can create with those two characters.
Were you given license to muck around a bit? How closely did you have to stick to the script? Because in some of those exchanges, I get a sense of playfulness.
We were pretty strict, actually. We sort of had a very, very... the hand of the director was very much all over the performance in terms of landing the rhythm of the comedy, which I know you understand.
Yep.
And because I don't work in comedy all the time, and it's not a genre I'm always in, I said to them, look, you know, feel free to really sculpt what I'm doing here because I can't necessarily hear how you want it to land.
Yes.
So we worked actually very, very hard on orchestrating all the beats and the rhythms, and it was a very disciplined set from that point of view.
Great. Mm. Well, more power to you because it comes off as playful and not necessarily light because there's moments of real tension.
Yeah.
Nadine Garner, I want to just step back slightly. I'm going to step back, whole way back in a moment. But how about the transition from playing Mrs. Black now to your last character, Beasley?
Yes.
Is that right?
She was Mrs. Blake.
Yes. Jean Blake / Beasley in the Blake Mysteries.
Yeah. Well, of course, going from – look, I love playing period drama because you get to – put on clothes that are beautiful and that have been made for you, and you get to spend an hour and a half in makeup, and you actually transform into someone of another time So from an acting point of view, you're given all these beautiful cues which help you find a character. In fact, they do all the work for you. Yeah. You walk into wardrobe and they put these amazing clothes on you. Then you walk into hair and makeup and they give you a 1940s hairstyle. And you walk out and you don't feel like yourself anymore. So you don't have to do very much to become another character.
You have to embody it. You've got to be a fabulous actor.
You can embody it, but there's a beauty in allowing all those other departments to sing around you and for them to show their incredible skills, which we have so many skilled practitioners in this country across that gambit of, you know, design, makeup and hair. You know, there's so many talented people, wig makers, prosthetics makers. These are all the unsung people who I work with who just absolutely live and die for their craft. So it's always an absolute honour for me to be able to showcase their work. I love working in period drama because I love the attention to detail in the set design. It's such a beautiful place to dwell. Having said that, I have done that show for 7 years, so to bust out of that and go contemporary again is really fantastic. And as an actor, of course, you want everything.
Yes.
You just want to do all of it all the time. Yeah. So the contradictions are what make it special.
And moving from one Blake to another, we don't need to go into that backstory, but there was a transition.
Yes. Yeah, so we tried to take the franchise, the show forward into, you know, the character of Mrs. Blake taking the show forward. Our network at the time were very, very kind to back us in that incredibly brave jump in trying to keep a brand afloat that people loved. And we certainly had a lot of pressure from our fan base to keep the show alive. They didn't seem to care what was happening with Craig. They just wanted to see Blake on screen. So we did all the mental gymnastics and produced something which put my character in the forefront. The network decided not to back it. And we kind of, you know, knew it was a long shot, but I'm really proud that we gave it a red hot go anyway.
Yeah, more power to you.
Thank you.
Now, the beauty of live radio, of course, is that you can be chatting with Nadine Garner, and someone out there in radio land remembers a young Nadine Garner. So why don't we get Kath on the phone? Hello, Kath.
Hello, Brian. I'm so delighted that you're talking about what Nadine Garner has acted in, but every time she comes on the radio, nobody ever mentions Class Act.
Oh!
I enjoyed that so much.
Kath, that is fantastic. You must have been one of the three people
on
11 o'clock on a Friday night that was watching that show.
I was thinking at the time, why is it on so late? Everybody would love this.
Well, it's a shame, Kath, because it was a Joanna Lumley show.
Yes.
And she was so big at the time. I just don't think the show was good enough for it to be won. I don't know, I actually don't really know, but it was a big chunk of my life that I've had to sort of pretend never happened because no one here knows about it.
Oh, but I enjoyed it so much and you were so funny in that.
That's lovely.
That
thank you for telling me that. That's made my day.
Well, I just checked to make sure my memory wasn't playing tricks, and I'm sure people can still watch it.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Kath.
Kath, just remind us about the period. Now, I'm assuming it was around a post Joanna Lumley on Ab Fab.
The first series was made in 1994, according to the screen I'm looking at the moment.
Yeah, so Joanna was making our show in between making Ab Fab. She was absolutely at the height of her. I think they were naming planets after her in Britain at the time.
And was she as remarkable as you would hope she would be?
Oh, my gosh, I hate to gush, but of all the people I've ever worked with in this industry, she is the person who I most think of as just being a consummate woman of such compassion, grace, humour, just a total joy to be around, very smart, blindingly intelligent, deeply compassionate, and you just want to be near her. Man, woman, child, insect, everyone wants to be near her. And I was just one of the many.
Oh, brilliant. Well, good on you, Kath. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Kath.
Oh, she's gone. She's racing off to do some more research. Nadine Garner, I did mention that I wanted to take you back because I'm always intrigued by the early days.
Yes.
And I thought we might just look at the three first appearances, theatre, TV and film. So let's start with your TV debut, Tamara in The Henderson Kids. Just a couple of quick vivid memories.
Yes. Look, obviously a total game changer for me. I was a kid. I was in school suddenly.
You were 15.
I was 13 turning 14. So I was the age my son is now. And I look at my son and I think, I was little, you know, I was little and I was taken into an adult world and I was working really hard and I did really well to hold up my end of the bargain. It was an amazing time. It wasn't something I'd planned, how can you at 13, but it really set me on the path that I'm on now and I'm very grateful that the universe put me there. It was an amazing opportunity.
Perfect. Your film debut, A Still Point, in 1986 alongside Ben Mendelsohn, Greg Fleet and Anna Funda.
Look, there's so many, and Steve Bastoni.
Steve Bastoni.
One of the many little kind of low budget Melbourne movies that were made. It was a sweet little film about a deaf girl's coming of age. It probably, I don't even know, it went to a few festivals, like so many things that we do, you know, no one ever sees them again. But it was a beautiful opportunity to do a feature film. Yeah, fantastic. And I was 14 or something. So, again, a massive learning curve. And I remember it all so clearly.
Do you?
I do.
And you were playing a deaf girl, Sarah?
Yeah. Yes, I was. So all those jobs way back in the early days, they stick because they're seminal to who you are and who you become as an artist. So, yeah, I draw on those experiences all the time. And I still have relationships with those people.
Well, how
Steve
great.
Bastoni is still a colleague. Who
yep. You
I'm
were in
very
Popcorn with him.
I was.
The Ben Elton production. That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking of Ben Mendelsohn and Greg Fleet, and I'm dropping names left, right and centre, but I do remember, and tying it in with Bob Dylan, I do have a very vivid memory of backstage, I'm not sure if it was the Last Laugh or the Prince Patrick Hotel, Greg, Ben and myself swapping lines from Brownsville Girl.
Yeah, of course, you would have been. There you go.
The Bob Dylan song.
Yeah, another couple of tragics. Bob Dylan tragics.
One more. First, your stage debut in A Day in the Life of Joe Egg.
I know.
For the MTC.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, That was again another really great stroke of luck because I'd been, you know, a television actor, then I'd had a role in a film and then someone said, oh, you should come and do this play. And I was working with Jackie Weaver.
Yes.
And Bruce Miles. And I was playing a severely mentally disabled child in a wheelchair. So it wasn't a happy role. It was a really difficult role. I had to do a lot of research and spend time with kids to try and capture, you know, the nuances of this kid in a wheelchair.
And how old are you?
At this time I'm 16.
You're 16?
Yeah, and I'm under the direction of Simon Phillips, who's a gigantic talent in this country as a director. So, again, you know, an amazing opportunity to watch beautiful performers at work and just try and piece it all together and work out where I fit in it, you know. So I've been very lucky.
Was it overwhelming at any stage? Because, I mean, for those who don't know, it's the story of a family. They are the husband and the wife are sort of slowly being torn apart by the problems of dealing with this disabled child.
Yeah.
The father contemplates extreme violence.
Yep.
Was it overwhelming for a 16-year-old to deal with those subjects?
I think back in those days we were a little more lenient in regards to how a rehearsal room was run. We didn't really have all the kinds of alarm bells going off in terms of, you know, protocol that we have now.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, I was considered an adult, I suppose. People didn't really stop and check in with me and see how I was dealing with the material. I understood that that was the case, and as a person in that situation, you just keep stepping up, and your brain just keeps expanding to kind of cope with what's going on. But the material's light. I mean, it's a very black comedy.
Yes, true.
Yeah. So we laughed a lot. Roger Oakley. We laughed, and I just kind of learnt more and more about adults as we went along.
Well, there you go.
Steep learning curve.
I mean, do you have your mum and your dad after the show taking you home saying, now, you know, that bit there and that bit there?
No, I was in taxis.
Oh, really? Not in your dad's charger?
No, mate. I would have loved to have been in the charger, but no. Look, my family had separated by then. It was kind of every man for himself. I say that with love, but it was just a different time, you know.
Right.
At 16, back in those days, you were an adult and you just got on with it.
So that was your first foray into the wonderful world of theatre. And I have to say, a friend of a friend of a friend did say that he believed your first love is the theatre.
Oh.
Would you say that?
I think, I would say that. I mean, I grew up being, you know, a kid going to dance classes and doing the old tap routines in the back of the church hall. I mean, and then doing your concert at the end of the year. The concert at the end of the year was almost my favourite time because it's in a theatre and I love a theatre. I still get a chill down my spine when I walk into a theatrical space. There is something beautiful about that agreement between an audience and a live show in this day and age where everything's electronic and so complicated. The fact that we still walk into a theatre and make that contract with a performer.
And the smell.
And the smell. The dust.
Theatres. The dust. I was in Perth not that long ago and we spent a couple of days at His Majesty's.
Beautiful.
Have you been to that theatre in Hay Street?
Oh, I have. I've performed in that theatre actually.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, beautiful.
Those theatres are so evocative. And there's also something I read someone said about being in the theatre and doing a theatrical production. It's like this beautiful dance.
Yes.
A clockwork dance that happens every night at the same time.
That's true.
And some actors find doing the same show night after night frustrating, but I'm quite happy to do the same thing.
Well, it changes, doesn't it, though, Brian? Every night there's something new that you have to find.
Oh, well, of course. And it has to be new. We've got some fabulous texts coming in here for Nadine Garner. This one, you're amazing, Nadine. Many years ago, Romeo and Juliet in the gardens, you forgot your lines, but carried on giggling and saying something like, I forgetteth my lines.
Oh, that was industrious of me.
Please wouldst thou prompteth my sweet memory. Joan in Harkaway.
Good God, I've blanked that out of my psyche, Joan. Thank you for reminding me of that. Did anyone prompt me or was I left hanging there in the middle of my sonnet? God, I hope I survived. I adored doing that show outside.
Was that a Glen Elston
production? It was. Yep. And back in those days, we were allowed to stand on top of the conservatorium, like the building that, you know, now it's all roped off and you can't go. It was fantastic. I loved it. I loved performing outside. I loved the fact that the audience was on the grass and it was all the way Shakespeare wanted it to be.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So
what do they call it? Site-specific.
Site-specific. Theater. That's right.
It's great.
It is fantastic. Have you done that
stuff? I did one on a tram.
Of course.
Storming St Kilda by tram. Storming Glenelg by tram in good old South Australia. And that was incredible. You had actors getting on and off.
Brilliant.
People in cars seeing things happen on a tram that they didn't realise were part of a play. And so I got into a fight and then I got off in somewhere just north of Glenelg and the police arrived. Because they'd been called and they threw me up against a wall and had my arm up behind my back. And I said, I'm in a play. And they said, yeah, mate, sure.
Oh, that's brilliant. And did the audience think that was part of the show?
Well, the tram kept going.
And you were left behind to explain yourself. Did they believe you? Did you say, don't you know who I am?
No, I didn't try that one. Nadine Garner, we do have to move to this occasional segment, Words That Rocked My World. Now, you suggested a Bob Dylan song.
Yes.
And you suggested one of the great Bob Dylan songs, not necessarily a Times They Are A-Changing or a Blowing in the Wind. Tell us about your selection.
Well, it's always difficult when someone says choose something that's got a lot of meaning for you, because we all have a lot of text and prose that has a lot of meaning for us, William Blake or whatever, anyone. We have so many things. This popped into my mind because it's a song that intrigues me about Bob Dylan's journey in his exploration of his own faith and his spirituality. And at this time when he wrote Every Grain of Sand, he'd sort of moved into a born-again Christian sort of phase, and he was looking back on himself as a man and as a human, the things he'd done wrong, his fallibilities, his sins, if you like. I'm not actually a practicing Christian, but I think what's interesting, as I get older and start examining the way I see the world and my mindsets and what I believe to be true and good, you know, I was probably raised with a Christian ethos, like a lot of us here in white Australia.
Yep.
And there's something in the writing of these words that just profoundly impacts on me. You know, it's not necessarily my faith, but it is something about a person's journey to come to a place of self-analysis and deep deep self-reflection that I find very moving.
Beautiful. Nadine, let's hear a verse as read by Nadine Garner.
I've gone from rags to riches in the sorrow of the night, in the violence of a summer's dream, in the chill of a wintry light, in the bitter dance of loneliness fading into space, in the broken mirror of innocence on each forgotten face. I hear the ancient footsteps like the motion of the sea. Sometimes I turn, there's someone there. Other times it's only me. I'm hanging in the balance of the reality of man, like every sparrow falling, like every grain of sand.
Nadine Garner, absolutely beautiful. We need to all rush out. I think it was on Shot of Love.
Yeah, Shot of Love, 1980.
1980.
That could have been written in 1880. Could have been written in the future. Right.
We got to go.
Thanks, Brian.
We could chat all day.
Oh, well, you bet we could.
Let's do a podcast.
Let's.
Thanks, Nadine.
Thank you.
Miff Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.